sidelines, Iran's president says his country will fulfill its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal once other signatories live up to their commitments. The Russian parliament's lower house votes to ratify an agreement to extend by 5 years a key nuclear pact with the United States. And also, Tunisia's parliament approves a cabinet reshuffle amid tensions triggered by daily protests against social inequality and police abuses. Our top story for this half hour, the Iranian president says the world agrees that the United States should make good on its commitments under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
All countries are of the opinion that the United States should return to its obligations. There is a consensus on that across the globe. The whole world is unanimously telling the U.S. to return to its commitments as soon as possible.
President Rouhani said Tehran scaled down its commitments under the nuclear deal because the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of it and Europe failed to fulfill its obligations. He said Iran will immediately return to all of its commitments as soon as other signatories do so. The Iranian president also noted that not only has the U.S. economic war on Iran failed, but its days are numbered as well. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump launched a maximum pressure campaign on Iran in 2018. The campaign has led to harsh sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Iran and Russia have called for the preservation of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, saying it's up to the U.S. to take the first steps by removing the sanctions if it's sincere in its assertion that it wants to go back to the nuclear deal. Marina Kortanova reports from Moscow.
Iranian Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Iran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus, plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then, of course, the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev.
Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Russian parliament's lower house has unanimously approved the extension of the New START nuclear arms control treaty with the United States. Russian lawmakers voted in favor of extending the treaty by 5 years on Tuesday. President Vladimir Putin and his U.S. counterpart held their first phone call since Joe Biden took office a week ago. They agreed that their teams work urgently to complete the extension before the New START treaty expires next week. The two countries had failed to reach such agreement under former U.S. President Donald Trump. Moscow and Washington signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty in 2010. It limits the number of nuclear warheads deployed by them to 1,550 each. Political commentator Jason Unruh says the latest agreement by the U.S. and Russia to extend their nukes control treaty could benefit all.
I'm certainly hopeful that the return to some kind of an agreement would be beneficial, not just for the United States, but for the rest of the world. I mean, the further proliferation of missiles and nuclear, particularly nuclear missiles, is not really good for the cause of world peace. What we're talking about is two very powerful countries that already possess the capability of defending themselves. Both countries both have weapons that are capable of destroying the entire world several times over. The proliferation of any more weapons by these two is completely unnecessary. It's not needed. However, if the threat of such a thing happening does happen, then everybody else has to follow suit. If, the old saying that if somebody builds a bomb and somebody else has to build a bomb and then somebody else builds a bigger bomb, they have to match it. If there could be some kind of an agreement to stop at some point, some rational point, then we have basically a position where the weapons are not escalating. And this signifies something very important because there are far better things that money could be spent on.
The U.S. Senate has confirmed Antony Blinken as Secretary of State with key members of the rival Republican Party backing him. The 100-member chamber controlled by Democrats endorsed Blinken 78-22. His easy confirmation is in contrast with former President Donald Trump's two secretaries of state, Mike Pompeo and Rex Tillerson. Both of them were opposed by most Democrats. Blinken is a longtime confidant of President Joe Biden. The new Secretary of State has pledged to work more closely with the U.S. allies. He has also promised to revitalize American diplomacy damaged under Trump. Tunisian lawmakers have approved a cabinet reshuffle as political differences remain between the prime minister and the president. Prime Minister Hisham Mishishi proposed a reshuffle earlier this month and named 11 new ministers. He did so in response to protests that began this year, but President Kais Saied has indicated that he would reject the cabinet reshuffle. He has said he was not consulted and some likely new ministers may have conflicts of interest. As the Tunisian parliament was debating the reshuffle, people were protesting outside. Demonstrators vented anger at social inequality and police brutality. They also want the country's political and economic problems to be resolved. Syria's ambassador to the United Nations says the Security Council must force Israel to end its occupation of Syrian territory, including the Golan Heights. Bashar al-Jafari was speaking at a Security Council meeting on the situation in the Middle East. He said the Israeli occupation is a threat to regional stability and security. Jafari said the regime continues its occupation thanks to the support it receives from some Western veto-wielding members of the Council. The Syrian envoy also slammed Israel for what he called repeated acts of aggression on his country. He said Israel has carried out over 50 attacks on Syria in less than a year, killing a large number of civilians. The latest Israeli attack took place near Hama on Friday. It killed four members of a family. Political analyst Tim Anderson says Syria's patience with Israeli attacks on its soil will not last forever.
Yes, look, the Israeli attacks on Syria have been carrying on over several years. The Israeli officials themselves have admitted there have been hundreds in recent years. I think the Syrian ambassador, Bashar al-Jafari, said there was at least 50 in the last year. In this last one, they killed a family of four civilians in Hama. But, you know, in international law, Israel has no right to kill anyone. No Iranian, no Syrian soldier, no civilians in Syria at all. They're breaching international law each time. And they're doing it because they're trying to prolong this conflict and to intervene when it seems that the Syrian government is making inroads against the al-Qaeda groups, whether in Idlib or the Daesh groups in the Eastern Desert. We know there's a resurgence there. So really, the UN Security Council has been stalled because, as the Syrian ambassador said, Britain, France, and the US are backing these al-Qaeda groups in Syria to prolong the conflict and to weaken Syria. And so the foreign minister said recently that Syria reserves its right to respond to Israel. Now, maybe the Israeli leaders are trying to provoke that, trying to provoke an escalation in the region, but the Syrians have been patient, but that patience can't go on forever.
On this edition of the News Review, an Israeli general claims the regime is refreshing its operational plans against Iran, saying the U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear agreement would be wrong.
Recently, we have seen, with the change of the administration in the U.S., the Iranians have already announced that they want to return to the previous agreement. I would like to state my position I share with all my counterparts when I meet them across the globe. A return to the 2015 nuclear agreement, or even if it's a similar accord with several improvements, is bad and wrong from an operational and strategic point of view.
Aviv Kochavi added that Iran's scaling back of its commitments under the 2015 nuclear accord show Tehran could be planning to build nuclear weapons. Kochavi stated that he has instructed the regime's forces to prepare a number of operational plans in addition to those already in place. The remarks come as the new U.S. administration mulls over returning to the JCPOA, which Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from in 2018. Tel Aviv has frequently threatened strikes against the Islamic Republic over its nuclear program. Tehran has also on several occasions reiterated that it will respond swiftly to any acts of aggression against the country. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mr. Scott Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign joining us from Edinburgh. Also, we have activist and political commentator Laith Maruf joining us from Beirut. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Napier. Let's jump right in. Give us your perspective on the recent claims by the Israeli regime.
Well, the threats from Hanegbi are rather vague. He talks about changing operational plans, but nothing in detail. And we should remember that over the last 5-6 years, the Israelis have alternated between threatening that they would attack Iran, but quite often moving from that to saying it's important for the USA to attack Iran because Israel couldn't quite do it. So the threats remain vague. They're real and should be taken very seriously. Remember that the same year as the joint agreement with Iran was signed, 2015, Netanyahu thanked Secretary of State John Kerry for blocking a conference on a nuclear-free Middle East, a conference that was supported by every other country in the region and many outside it, and was opposed only by the USA, Israel, of course, and my own government, the UK. That determination to avoid a nuclear-free Middle East was reiterated last year at the UN conference, I think late 2019, where every country again was present except Israel. So it's very serious because the Israelis are determined to use their nuclear weapons to leverage their power throughout the region. The New York Times ran a story that in 1967 the Israelis were threatening to detonate a nuclear weapon in Egyptian Sinai if the war had gone against them. It didn't. But again, they also threatened a nuclear weapon. According to UPI, according to senior U.S. diplomats who told the news agency, they also threatened a nuclear weapon on Cairo in 1973 when that war was going badly for a period of time against Israel. So the Israelis have used these threats in the past. They are determined that they will maintain a nuclear monopoly in all serious matters across the Middle East, and it's quite possible that they might try to mount an attack on Iran. But in order to do that, they will need the cooperation of either Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Jordan, which would pose serious threats for those governments in terms of their own public opinion. So Israel's determined to destabilize the situation. It's determined to ramp up stress and tension throughout the region. Whether it can actually carry out these threats is quite another matter.
Laith Maruf, your thoughts on the issue. Do you agree with Mr. Napier as the Israelis are, in fact, after destabilization?
definitely there after destabilization, but we have to be very clear that apartheid Israel doesn't have the capability to attack Iran's nuclear sites. And if it did, it would have attacked them a decade ago, not yesterday, not the day before. And, you know, just like they did attack the Iraqi nuclear reactor as it was built, the supposed Syrian nuclear reactor that was being built before the beginning of the 2000s. So, in reality, apartheid Israel needs the American military to attack Iran because it does not have the capability to do so. We saw the threats of the B-52s flying in multiple times on the borders of Iran before Trump left office. And that's the only thing that they can use to actually attack Iran if they want to, which means that the United States, if it actually does not join a war, even with the vessels of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, or Jordan joining apartheid Israel in a war with Iran, they will be decimated. And they know that. And so we have just the Zionists barking right now in fear of the American retreat from the region. Although Biden is increasing the military forces, American occupation forces in Iraq and Syria, they will be leaving eventually because they have reached a dead end to how much the United States can project power. And to be very frank, if the United States or apartheid Israel attacks Iranian nuclear sites, even without using a nuclear weapon in that attack, the effects would be equivalent to a nuclear detonation. The whole region will be living a nuclear fallout from those attacks, and their response from not only Iran, but the whole world would be eternal condemnation for apartheid Israel and its Jewish supremacist ideology that birthed it.
All right, unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to Mr. McNapier joining us from Edinburgh. Also, thanks to Laith Maddow speaking to us from the Lebanese capital. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The necessity to reform the budget structure and the banking system, to improve investment and employment rate, and to boost the business environment.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
Another issue is about the obstacles in the way of surge in production. It has been suggested that the heads of the three branches appoint a special team, the representatives of the heads of the three branches, so that it will try to identify and eliminate these obstacles. The heads of the three branches should discuss this in their meeting and reach a certain conclusion. These are tasks that should be carried out in the short term, with immediate effect, and they should be given priority. All organizations, governmental, private, and semi-private organizations should cooperate with one another in order to do this. But the main reforms are the ones that I announced 2 years ago to the Economic Council of the three branches of the government. One is reforming the budget structure, which is very important. Another is reforming the banking system. And the last one is improving investment and the employment rate. Of course, since long ago, investment has been undermined in the country and the necessary measures have not been adopted in this area. This problem has been there for 10 to 12 years, but it should be made up for. This is one of the long-term actions. Another task is to boost the business environment. I have put forward these demands and the honorable gentlemen are working hard, but no noteworthy progress has been witnessed. Nonetheless, we know what we want, and this is what counts. We know what we are looking for and what our plans are. These tasks should be accomplished. These were a few points about economic matters.
Your light and love, all I see, a thing or I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Me faith to be stronger.
Lord, anyone in glory.
want to say something about the future as well. In my opinion, in order to ensure future progress, we need patience and stability. We should make our steps firm. Our Lord, forgive us our sins and anything we may have done that transgressed our duty. Establish our feet firmly. The Holy Quran, chapter 3, verse number 147. One of the things asked in this dua is making one step firm. Patience and constancy are what we need. Of course, our people are fortunately patient. We have experienced this, and we know that thanks to their faith and thanks to their trust in the system, in the country, and in the Islamic Republic, the people are really patient and firm. Officials too should show their patience and firm steps with jihadi work. In my opinion, jihadi work is really necessary. Having hesitations and concerns about whether this or that will happen or not, or whether we should do this or that or not do them at all, is really harmful. Officials should pay attention to these points.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States on January 20th during an inauguration ceremony that wasn't attended by his predecessor, Donald Trump. The reason for that absence was made clear just hours after when Biden signed over a dozen executive orders reversing policies adopted by the previous U.S. administration. The Biden administration says it will roll back Trump's policies that are harmful to Americans and to the rest of the world. The new president signed an order lifting the so-called Muslim ban. The U.S. will rejoin the Paris Agreement on Climate Change and cancel the Keystone XL pipeline. Biden has also taken action on the COVID-19 pandemic and signed an executive order to rejoin the World Health Organization. Absent from the announced Biden 100-day program, however, is any proposed reversals of Israel policies implemented by the Trump administration that risk security concerns of a global scale, including moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, extorting Arab countries to recognize Israel, U.S. recognition of Golan Heights as part of Israel, U.S. support for Israeli annexation of the West Bank, and the assassination of foreign figures.
Anything you want to do in the United States as president or Congress or almost any part of government, you need Israeli permission. You know, Israel is the one that allows you to do things and puts a veto on anything they don't like. It's very unusual for the United States to do something that Israel doesn't like. And in this case, Israel doesn't want to reverse any of these policies.
In his confirmation session in the Senate, Biden's pick for Secretary of State Anthony Blinken stresses support for a two-state solution to the Palestinian problem. But he remained silent on the many concessions made to Tel Aviv during the Trump administration, leading Israel to believe that the new administration's policies won't differ much from that of the former president. In the first volume of his presidential memoir, A Promised Land, Barack Obama writes about the pressure exerted from Israeli lobbies. He wrote that American politicians who criticized Israel policy too loudly risk being tagged as anti-Israel and possibly anti-Semitic, and were confronted with a well-funded opponent in the next election. He added that Israel's supporters in the U.S. use accusations of anti-Semitism to stifle criticism of the regime's policies against the Palestinians. The former U.S. president further hit out at the pro-Israeli lobby, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, saying that the group moved to the right ideologically to mirror Netanyahu's administration and defended Israel even when its actions were contrary to U.S. policy. Obama also wrote that while congressional Republicans did not care about Palestinians' rights, their Democratic counterparts were, quote, worried about angering AIPAC and losing its support. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he opposes West Bank settlements construction in line with an international consensus that Israeli structures in the occupied Palestinian lands violate international law. He has further vowed to return to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which Trump abandoned in May 2018. In such a political climate, as described in Obama's memoir, Biden will be fighting an uphill battle should he decide to overturn any of Trump's policies on Israel.
Frankly, I think that Biden is afraid of trying to reverse any of these. And why take a chance? Israel's happy with it, just leave it alone. That's the way he looks at it.
Only time will tell whether Biden, who faces numerous challenges both from the inside and abroad, would choose to risk his political career, which culminated in his presidency, by going against Israel's agenda.
On Wednesday, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. In his first speech as the U.S. President, he pledged to defeat political extremism and domestic terror.
The rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism, that we must confront and we will defeat.
2 days later, Biden ordered the Director of National Intelligence to work with the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security to conduct a comprehensive assessment of the threat from domestic violent extremism.
We're committed to developing policies and strategies based on facts, on objective and rigorous analysis, and on our respect for constitutionally protected free speech and political activities. Our initial work on DVE will broadly fall into three areas. The first is a tasking from President Biden sent to the ODNI today, requesting a comprehensive threat assessment coordinated with the FBI and DHS on domestic violent extremism.
The fast-paced move shows how seriously the new U.S. administration is taking the issue in the aftermath of the January 6th demonstration in which pro-Trump protesters overran the Capitol. The National Intelligence Office was created in 2001 after the September 11 attacks with the goal of combating international terrorism. The involvement of the National Intelligence Office suggests that U.S. authorities are examining how to pivot to a more concerted focus on violence from extremists at home.
People in the U.S. who don't want any more wars, who want money to be used for poverty and homelessness here, those people are now going to be cracked down on with the same policies that they're using to the right-wing extremists. And so I think it took a while for the Biden administration and the Democrats to do this, because I think now they're also going to use it to attack people on the anti-imperialist left, the anti-war left, who don't want any conflict abroad.
What happened to the U.S. Capitol raised questions about whether federal government national security apparatus that for decades has moved aggressively to combat what it called threats from foreign terror groups is adequately equipped to address the threat of domestic terrorism. In U.S. Congress, lawmakers passed a measure requiring intelligence agencies to work on annual reports and strategic assessments of domestic extremism. Many lawmakers blame far-right white supremacist extremism as the most dangerous threat in America. Indeed, they have evidence for their claim. A report conducted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies shows that white supremacists and other far-right groups conducted two-thirds of the terrorist plots and attacks in the U.S. in 2020. It says that anarchists and other like-minded extremists orchestrated 20% of the plots and attacks, although the number of incidents grew from previous years. These groups mostly targeted law enforcement, military, and government facilities and personnel. Last August, Michael German, a former FBI special agent, published a report in which it said white supremacist groups have infiltrated U.S. law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the last two decades. The report said U.S. law enforcement officials have been tied to racist militant activities in more than a dozen states since the year 2000. It noted that hundreds of police officers have been caught posting racist and bigoted social media content. The report said the main reason U.S. law enforcement have failed to respond to far-right domestic terror threats is that they are involved in such crimes.
From the very beginning, the U.S. state intelligence apparatus, whether it's domestic or foreign, the FBI, the CIA, has been based entirely on the enslavement of African people, of indigenous peoples. And so this notion that Biden and the Democrats are going to crack down on racism within and try to eradicate it is kind of nonsense, because at its very core, the U.S. state has been repressive, has been based on colonialism, slavery.
Concerns about alleged relations between far-right groups and law enforcement in the U.S. have intensified since the start of the protest movement sparked by the police killing of George Floyd in the summertime. But when footage of the protest rally on January 6 showed some police officers were letting protesters enter the building, the authorities started to worry. Investigation shows that there were off-duty officers in the rally and helped others to storm the Capitol building. A poll conducted by Reuters news agency after the insurrection at the Capitol found that 12% of Americans have supported the move. With their enormous power, department-issued weapons, and access to sensitive information, police departments have become attractive recruiting grounds for white supremacist groups. Because of the secretive nature of such groups, it is hard to say how many officers are involved. But since 2009, police officers in dozens of U.S. states have been identified as members of white supremacist groups.
It seems that as Britain left the European Union at the end of last year, the inevitable was going to happen to the British economy as a direct consequence of Brexit, with goods, services and business essentially halting their flow between London and the EU, leaving the British economy gasping for air. Add to this the devastating impact of the COVID-19 virus, which has placed the country into its third lockdown, and there's no doubt that Britain is entering a double-dip recession as COVID-19 cases surge across Britain. With the full impact of Brexit yet to be felt until the end of the first quarter of 2021, the end of 2020 saw the British economy sink by some 2.6%, leaving it easy to predict that things will get a lot worse come spring as Britain sinks further into misery. The cases of COVID-19 in the UK has put the country at the top of the global list when it comes to the worst death rate in the world, with daily death rates in the last few days fluttering around the 2,000 mark, meaning the knock-on effect towards the economy is proving to be equally as fatal. All eyes are now on the UK from Brussels and the rest of Europe to study how they're faring since their departure from the bloc, with many keen to show that by leaving the EU, the future does not look bright, and it's hence aimed at discouraging others to emulate a Brexit of their own. Yet Germany, and in particular Deutsche Bank, have looked at the British economy and concluded that three major factors have contributed to the decline, with two of the main reasons coming from the impact of Brexit rather than that of COVID-19, something that the British will not care to admit. So just how big a fall will the second dip be for Britain? Will it be worse than the first one? And just how long will it take the UK to climb out of a very deep, dark and slippery hole that it's found itself in?
Well, GDP will shrink, likely between 5 and 25%. It depends on how long this lockdown will last, and we have now indications it will be another extension and another extension and another extension, as happened throughout 2020, where initially it was we were told it was going to be 2 weeks. It turned out to be longer than 2 weeks. So we have to expect most of 21 is going to be a lockdown year. And that will, in that case, of course, we have to look at the bigger figures of GDP contraction, 25 to 30%.
Much like Britain, the EU has felt the impact of the COVID-19 virus. But unlike Britain, the EU has a multitude of industries and services that it can rely on to contribute to the economy, to sway things back into the black in times of crisis. Yet it seems that so heavy is the impact of the third wave of the pandemic been on the EU, that the financial commitments made by Brussels have not caught up with the Eurozone, which could see as many as 19 EU states fall into a deeper recession as a result. Already signs are looking bleak for the EU, with the zone seeing its Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, fall to below 50 points to 49.1, indicating a serious downturn in economic activity, sparked by the stringent lockdowns rolling out again across the EU. But the EU has demonstrated the ability to work together to find solutions. The 2008-2009 global crash was a fine example of such camaraderie, but with things taking an impact on a much larger scale this time round, will coming out of another recession prove to be more demanding this time round?
No, I mean, you know, that's not any more difficult. The problem is, why are we shrinking the economy artificially by shutting down everything and prohibiting business activity? Why are we restricting individual freedoms, and why are we particularly annihilating small and medium-sized enterprises, particularly in service sector, catering, all sorts of face-to-face type of businesses? Is this justified? Where's the cost-benefit analysis? There's never been any, and it doesn't make sense. And of course, the longer you do this, the bigger the contraction.
The future ahead now falls in the hands and arms, it seems, of the people of Europe, as various vaccines are deployed to try and stop the virus once and for all. Yet the sheer logistical scale of such an operation, coupled with the already crippling effect on the economy caused by the virus, will mean that many more will suffer before things start to return to any notion of normality for Europe. The end of the Cold War came as a huge relief to the people of the world, who felt that the bipolar world order tension had finally ended and the world could settle down and live in peace. However, it seems that the Western powers still needed a scapegoat to target, and hence the birth of Islamophobia was commenced, and in the process, the Western media created a new enemy. Yet in 2015, following a spate of numerous events around the world, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, wrote a letter to the youth of the Western world asking them to ignore the media and reconsider the image of Islam. But it seems that the leader's message of 6 years ago is still very much valid today, as his words are well reflected in the ongoing spreading of fear and the spreading of hatred demonstrated by Western leaders towards Islam and Muslims in general. One only has to look at the far-right ideologies of ex-US President Donald Trump, who during his tenure instigated one of the most controversial and discriminatory laws ever passed when he executed his so-called travel ban on countries with a majority Muslim population. Although it was not Trump who started Islamophobia, he certainly added fuel to the fire through his words and actions.
I'm here to protest Donald Trump's racist, xenophobic immigration order, which is against everything that America is about and against everything I stand for as a human.
Yet the leader of the Islamic Revolution raised a very valid point 6 years ago, and is one that stands true more than ever today as technology advances and has encouraged the youth of the world to break down the barriers fabricated across the globe and use the tools and resources so readily available to educate themselves about the truth, hence exposing the lies and deceit created and encouraged by the likes of Donald Trump et al. When it comes to Islam. With some people being led to believe that Islam is the world enemy, so many fail to see the consequences of Western actions, either directly or indirectly against Islam and Muslims, hence proving that back in 2015, the leader knew that the time had come for enlightenment, and as the message stands as strong as ever today, sadly, the youth of the West are still falling to the influence of negative images, catalyzed and sparked by real extremists around the world, whose sole aim is to create division and tension between mankind. When the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo published offensive pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, the Muslim world reacted with anger, stating that the line between freedom of speech and respect for religion and faith had been breached, and saw the resulting attack on the HQ of Charlie Hebdo condemned by the world over, including Muslims, who were horrified by the extremist reaction. Yet the republication of the cartoons, as well as the rise of the far right that stemmed from the events, have seen a huge rise of Islamophobia in France, and is something that's almost been encouraged by French leaders who have failed to condemn the actions taken under the so-called pretext of free speech. Yet it seems that time is not a healer when it comes to such acts, as the rise of Islamophobia begins to gather pace across Europe, in part assisted by the French, exporting their model of Islamophobia across the continent, according to the international head of CAGE, an NGO based in the UK that fights against the discrimination against Muslims. Although the world is currently distracted by events such as the COVID-19 pandemic and various social political events around the world, some have taken a stance against the ongoing phenomenon of Islamophobia, making sure the problem is brought to the attention of the highest authorities. It's hence why some 36 NGOs from across 13 nations around the world have sought intervention by the United Nations to tackle the problem from the top, encouraging world leaders to take a stance against Islamophobia as they would any other form of discrimination or hate. What now remains to be seen is whether a change of president in the US and the lifting of the so-called travel ban will start a new era in the world order and encourage other world leaders and the youth of the West to take a new look at Islam and finally understand that hatred being spread by a small minority should once and forever remain a thing of the past.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: من شقاء العيش ضيق المنزل.
Imam al-Baghir alayhi salam stated, a misfortunate way of life entails living in a cramped house.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the historical textbooks a very interesting and profound conversation between a student and a teacher, a disciple and a master. In this beautiful tradition, which in reality is a conversation between a very knowledgeable student by the name of Jabir bin Yazid and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in this conversation we find very profound statements are put forth. Now, as we have said in prior segments, the conversation itself is quite long, so we have decided to pick out bits and pieces of this conversation between this student and the master, which are applicable to our lives. Now, of course, as we have said, this conversation is full of commandments which inculcate moral standards and beautiful ideals in human beings, to the extent that if one were to apply all of these standards which have been stated in this conversation, then it could very well lead one towards perfection. So one of the things that Imam al-Baqir said in this conversation with Jabir bin Yazid was that there is no disaster like your disdaining the sin and your satisfaction with the conditions in which you are. And so here we find that Imam al-Baqir is telling us that considering a sin to be small or overlooking a sin because we believe it is small, or perhaps not worrying about the sins which we commit, is in actuality a great disaster. And also, he says to Jabir bin Yazid that to be satisfied, complacent, easy, and comfortable with the condition that you are in is also a disaster. And why? Because we find that when we are complacent in the conditions in which we are, if it's okay, it's not a big deal, then there is no room for us to make progress. And if you are not making progress, then you are stagnant. And just like water goes bad when it is stagnant, so do the lives of people. And so we must always remember to continuously be in the mode of making progress, whether little or much. Beautiful words exchanged between student and teacher, between Jabir bin Yazid and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in this very historical and profound dialogue. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Imama of Imam al-Baqir was for 19 years. And especially from the time 95 to 114 when he passed away, this time was the time of spreading the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And the main factors, or one factor specifically, which made Imam al-Baqir to be able to spread the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt to Muslims in generally and in Shias in particular, it was the time of shift of power from Bani Umayyah to Bani Abbas. They were busy fighting against one another. Imam got the opportunity and he started spreading knowledge. And this, according to historians, the period was known as Ahadul Infiraj, grace period, when Imam alayhi salam decided to teach specifically the Shia and generally all Muslims, including Abu Hanifa and many other figures, came to learn from him.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
E-Waste Tragedy, Part 1.
This is one of the most notorious dump sites for e-waste in the world. We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like this dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago to see youngsters who work in the toxic smoke while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage.